Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today our guest for the hour is Allie Condy. We're going to be talking about her latest novel, The Unwedding. Allie Braithwaite Condy is the author of the number one New York Times bestselling Matched series and the Edgar Award finalist Summer Lost, among other novels. Also author of several picture books, including Here. A former English teacher, Allie Condy resides outside of Salt Lake City with her family, including her four children. She has an MFA from Vermont College of Fine Arts and is founder and director of the nonprofit Write Out Foundation. Join us for a conversation with Utah author Allie Condy following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today our guest is Utah author Allie Condy. We're going to be talking about her latest novel, The Unwedding, among other of her books. Allie Braithwaite Condy is the author of the number one New York Times bestselling Matched series and the Edgar Award finalist Summer Lost, among other novels, and author of several picture books, including Here. She's a former English teacher. Allie Condy resides outside of Salt Lake City with her family, including her four children. She has an MFA from the Vermont College of Fine Arts and is a founder and director of the nonprofit Write Out Foundation. Allie Condy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom. It's a delight to be here.
A pleasure. I want to get a little background from before we jump into The Unwedding, which is a departure for you, a murder mystery. So I understand that you really were a writer almost from the womb, very, very young. You were at least telling stories.
Yeah, that's true. I think people kind of come with a way that the world, or that they make sense of the world. And some people it's music, some people it's athletics or moving their body. I mean, all of these things are great and we all do some of them to some extent. But for me, it was telling stories. So yeah, even before I could write, I had this really nice babysitter who would basically take dictation from me. She would sit down and I would say, here's the story for today. And I'd tell it to her and bless her. So that was how I kind of got started. I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew I wanted it down permanently somewhere. So
so was this always a goal? I think you went to BYU to teach writing, maybe English, I guess, with a view to teaching.
A little bit. Well, yes, teaching was the goal. So I had some wonderful teachers and coaches in high school, and I knew it was hard to make a living as a writer. And so I thought I'll be a teacher. And I loved teaching, and I got a degree in English education from BYU and taught in Utah and New York for a few years. And then I started having kids and I missed my students so much. I thought maybe I should try writing a book for that age group. And that was how I got started, just when the kids were napping and all of that, I would work on that story.
So young kids, that's not a schedule for lengthy writing periods. You really did snatch time, I guess.
Yeah. And my husband at the time was in graduate school. And so he was gone a lot. And so I just tried to write during nap time or when I was alone in the evenings. And that worked pretty well. You can get a lot done if you just sort of chip away at it. And also for part of the time we were living back east, we were the house parents in a sorority with our little kids. And it was a really fun job. And also I was surrounded by 19-year-old girls. So I was lucky in that way in that I was thinking about teenagers and what they were saying and doing sort of all the time.
That's interesting. How do you, is that posted somewhere?
Yes, actually.
Work in a sorority?
At the time, this was a while ago. We were living in Ithaca, which is, and we're associated with Cornell University. And at the time, they preferred, the Greek system preferred for their sororities to only advertise. It wasn't a mandate or anything, but they just sort of ended up often advertising on what was back then the LDS listserv because they knew that the house parents were pretty stable and we didn't drink. And so there were a lot of us. It was actually a really fun time living kind of on the same street with young parents with little kids who the wives were putting the husbands through graduate school. That was just sort of the demographic back then. Now I think a lot more women are going to are getting their graduate degree as well. But back then it was a lot of us supporting them, and we had this really fun group of moms, and we'd watch each other's kids. Some of us were getting dental hygienist certifications. Some of us, like me, were trying to write books. Some people were aerobics instructors. So it was this really great community of women who supported each other and helped each other kind of follow their dreams, even though we'd put them on hold for to support these men in our lives.
Have you kept in touch with those women?
Yeah, I have. And they're still wonderful, still friends. A lot of them moved away to different universities, but a couple of them have ended up at Provo, where I ended up because of where my ex-husband was hired. And some are in Australia, and some are in, this, but we all keep in touch, and it's really great.
And I guess where life has taken them, right? A lot of different varied experiences, I would expect.
Yes, very much so. Some people lived in Korea. I mean, people took jobs at universities, London, all across the world, and so that's been really, really interesting to watch and visit them there sometimes too.
So, you're writing during nap time, I guess, and when the kids finally go to bed, a lot of writers need a lot of time. You gotta get rev up to speed and crank out a lot of pages. You couldn't do that, so I guess you just adjust your brain to doing that.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the ideal, but I just never had that. And so I kind of learned how to do it efficiently. And later I read a book a few years ago called Deep Work by Cal Newport, who talks about how the brain can do really, really deep work for about 90 minutes and then it needs a break. And I thought, well, hey, maybe this wasn't the worst thing all along. But yeah, definitely it's challenging, and I don't mean to make light of it. Sometimes I didn't even get 90 minutes, but I did feel like if I kind of at least kept my brain in the story and looked at it most days, then my subconscious would work on it too, and I'd get ideas throughout the day and write them down. So by the time I actually sat down, everybody was napping, I was pretty efficient.
What was the first book you got published?
It's called Yearbook, and it was published by Deseret Book.
Tell me a little bit about that one.
So that one was really fun to write, and that was the first book I wrote. And it was kind of a year in the life of a high school. So there were multiple points of view, and I was really, really just enjoying it. I don't know why a lot of my books do have multiple narrators. That's just sort of how I write. A lot of them don't too, but yeah, so that was the first one, and I don't know why I thought that would be a great idea to have multiple narrators for my first novel. But it was a fun one to write, and I enjoyed working with Deseret Book as well. And then eventually I got some ideas that felt like I should try selling them elsewhere.
So a lot of authors, it's one or two or multiple books written, but they're not the first ones published, right? Was this the first one you wrote?
It was, yeah. So that was kind of lucky, in that it was the first one published. And I also feel like I published 5 books with Deseret Book, and that was sort of a great place for me to get my start because of a lot of reasons. One of them was that there's an editor there, Lisa Mangum, who my book wasn't as good as it needed to be, as most aren't, but she really gave me the chance to rewrite it, kind of like learning on my own terms. She'd ask great questions. She'd put me through my paces, but she made me do the work. She didn't tell me what to do. And all of it ended up being almost like the perfect inoculation for sort of what happened later with the surprising sort of skyrocketing success of Matched. I felt like, oh, I'm glad I've done this before. I feel like a lot of good, solid ground under my feet instead of just having my first book hit the New York Times list. I had sort of done the work prior to that, learning about being a writer and managing my time, and that was a real gift.
Tell me a little bit more about that process, learning to be a writer. I guess you learn by doing, right? You write.
Yeah, for me at least. And I said all that, and probably it would have been amazing if my first book took off and was a New York Times bestseller. But that wasn't my trajectory, and that was a really a benefit. There's benefits to all things, I'm sure. But for me, it was learning, okay, what's my writing process? How do I build a novel? And every novel's different. You end up learning it different. You're learning something new every time, but also managing my time. Like my schedule came third. First the kids, then my spouse, then mine. And so I became really good at meeting deadlines and getting things done sort of at the edges of what was given to me. And that is something that's definitely not ideal. I wish that it had been a little different now looking back, but it stood me in good stead. You know, there's not, I don't usually miss deadlines. I don't waste time when I sit down to write. It's still hard. I still get writer's block, but I also don't get precious about it, if that makes sense. Like I definitely sit down and try to put words on the page as often as I can.
Want to talk a little bit about the Match, the series, and then we'll get into The Unwedding and then maybe loop back to some other books after. But so for those, the handful of people who maybe haven't encountered Matched, it's a
You're
New
so
York
nice.
Times bestseller. But give us the, kind of the outline in brief.
Yeah, so that is still my most widely read book, and I'm always happy to talk about that. I feel really fondly about that series, and there's a lot of great, just still forward momentum with that. It still sells really well 14 years on, which is pretty awesome. As an English teacher, a former English teacher too, that's very fun for me to see. But yeah, that was just an idea I had. I happened to hit at the right time writing dystopian when dystopian was huge, and it never really goes away, but that was a great time. I sort of landed in between The Hunger Games and Divergent just with when I happened to write it. And that was a sweet spot. That was a fun era. We call it now kind of the golden era, where a lot of things were getting published and people didn't, or kids didn't have smartphones yet. Now we used to say we're competing with all the other books on the shelf, and now we're competing with everything a kid has on their phone. And so that's just a different paradigm, but kids still read and they still are looking for stories. So that one was a book about a girl who lives in the future where the government decides who you marry. And it's a romance, and there's a lot of fun stuff in book two where they escape the government and the society. And whenever I tell people about the plot, all my Republican friends say, "Wow, this is such an indictment of the Obama or Biden administration." And when I tell Democrats, they say, "Way to take George Bush and Donald Trump to task." So it does make me laugh. It is a little bit of a Rorschach test, but it's a book about love and poetry and adventure. And I got to set the second book in Capitol Reef, which is a really a place that's dear to my heart. So I'm just out to tell a good story and make and have kids like reading it. That as an English teacher, I realized like you can't be didactic. You can't have a message other than a human message. What you're looking for is good writing, which I hope this is, but also a story that kids want to turn the pages on.
Now, I've read that at least part of this idea came from the temp view prom. Is that true?
Yes. You have done your homework, Tom. Yeah, I used to chaperone the dances when I was teaching at Timview High because I wanted to make some extra money, because back then and still now we don't pay our educators what we should. And so we're always picking up extra work. And it was really fun when I chaperoned prom. I'm from Cedar City, which was smaller then. It's exploded a bit too. And at Timview Prom, they would have it on the steps of the courthouse, and they would roll a literal red carpet out, and they'd ever announce everyone's names and pair them off. And as a 22-year-old who'd grown up in Cedar City, a first-year teacher, I thought this is the fanciest thing I have ever seen or will see. And that just sort of lodged in my brain. And then 7 or 8 years later, when I was writing Matched, I thought, what do I want this opening scene to look like? And I thought, oh, because there's the government element. I thought, what if it looked like Timview Prom, but evil, where there's, there's the government building that we're holding this at, and people are getting paired off, but this time they're not choosing it. So yeah, that was absolutely true.
Think that there's a very good impulse from this tradition. I don't know if it's still going on, but I guess the junior girls who haven't been asked,
Yes. Yeah, you really did read deeply.
the senior boys are assigned to choose one of them, I guess. So sweet, but I could see where it could go dystopian in your mind.
Oh, it could go sideways so fast. Yeah, back when I was there, there would always be a group of senior boys who would make sure that all the junior girls had a date to the dance. And my kids actually Know people who go to TempU now, and I don't know that it's still going on. There's so many ways it could get problematic. A girl could feel like a pity date, or a girl could want to go with another girl, or there's lots of ways that could go south. But at the time, it felt largely positive, and so, but yeah, I was definitely thinking about this could go so badly. So, so that later that came to mind as I was working on the book.
So you have a kernels of ideas, right? Dystopian government, young people are matched. And then do you plot out your entire book ahead of time?
I don't. I wish I did. It would be such a more efficient writing process. I have a lot of friends who are outliners, and I always admire how well it goes for them, where I'm just sort of chaos every day. But I've learned that for me, character comes first, and I don't know the characters until I've spent time with them, and so I usually don't know what they would do until I've written them for a while. And so that makes for very messy first drafting. I almost have what I term a draft zero. And I've heard Shannon Hale, I think you, who's a friend and a writer, use that phrase before, where just the pressure's off. This is draft zero. This is me telling the story to myself, and then we'll figure out how to make it work for everyone else. But I do always keep a running outline. About 50 pages in, I know how I want it to end. It's not as if I'm not writing towards something or I don't have ideas. It's just a little bit more, I guess, organic than outlining, but that can be very organic too. We all do it different ways. So that's just the way my brain works.
So you write characters, right? They're your creation, but
Right.
I've heard authors say that the characters then take over at a certain point.
Yeah, they do. And that I know that always sounds so funny to people who aren't authors, that we're aware they're coming from our brain. We're not crazy, but you do develop and invent, and then there is a point where you feel like, and it's an exciting point where you feel like, oh, they're taking on their own lives. I'm not going to have all say in what they do. And that for me is one of the best parts of being a writer, is when they start to feel real and separate from you.
So the a young adult in this case, right, the matched trilogy. You can remember how you were at that age. I guess you're interacting as a teacher with young adults. Is that how you get the, I guess, the details right, the nuances?
Yeah, I'm not a teacher anymore, but just the way my life has panned out, I've always been in association with young adults. Either I was a teacher, or we were living in the sorority, or I was working with the youth group at my church, or I have teenagers, and now I'm teaching at BYU. So they're not all teenagers, but there are some freshmen and sophomores. So that's been a lucky part of my life, that I've always had the chance to be associated with that age group.
So how did the success of Matched change your life? I guess it's nice to have a bestseller. I don't know what
Yeah.
is that does that grease the wheels a little bit with your publisher? What happens then?
Yeah, it changed everything. So at that time, I had been publishing with Deseret Book, and then Matched, and indeed all of my young adult novels have since been published with Penguin Young Readers, which is now Penguin Random House. They have merged. And so that was just a different level of everything. I was going on book tour, and there were more speaking engagements, and people were inviting me to speak at things. And so all of that really picked up, and Deseret Book had done a great job. It is just such a smaller market that none of those were things that I had to do for them, really. And then I was getting the book sold in over 30 countries, so I was getting offers to go on foreign book tours. And at the time, I said no to those because my family was so young, and I still think that was the right decision. But yeah, there were a lot of things I had to say no to that, probably don't come around again. But that was more navigating than I'd had to up to that point. But also, it was more readers, which is really fun. Really fun to get their emails. Wonderful to see people show up to your events. And that was such a gift. And then it was also, it was tricky. Like, I don't know that in Mormon culture, we're prepared often for dual career families. And so I think that was tough. And so there were a lot of things personally that kind of took place that I don't think would have happened had I not been so successful, in a way that sort of surprised us all. And that's not to say that I was that successful, but I was definitely more than we anticipated, and it's been interesting to watch that unfold. But so much fun having readers. As a former teacher, I keep saying that, but I loved putting a book in the hands of kids when I could match a kid to a book, and the thought that people out there are liking mine, that young students maybe are reading it, that just feels kind of magical to this day. It always does.
I don't know how your old your kids were when Matched hit. What did they think?
So Match came out when I was 32, so they were 8, 5, and 2, and then I ended up having another child as well. So they thought nothing.
Yeah, right.
they were great and cute, and they've all since read the books, except for I have one son who doesn't read much. He's neurodivergent and has autism, and he prefers to read things that matter to him, like menus and restaurants and other things like that. So he hasn't, but they've all read them, and that's a fun moment when you catch your kid wrapped up in your own book. That's pretty magical. They're honest about it too. My oldest, when he read it, he said, "Well, on a scale of 1 to Brandon Sanderson, it's an 8." And I know Brandon, and I told him that, and that was great. And I felt pretty pleased. I thought 8 is pretty high. Like,
Yeah.
that's, you know. So,
High praise on the Sanderson scale. That's good.
but they are really direct about
Yeah.
it.
I guess the final question on this. There was some talk of making the Match series into movies, I guess.
Yeah, it's been optioned several times by a bunch of different people. Disney optioned it, Brad Pitt's production company optioned it, Charlize Theron's production company optioned it, and just nothing's panned out. I think that happens a lot with properties, and so maybe someday something will happen, but for now it just keeps getting optioned. But
Yeah.
it would be cool to see it on the big screen or the small screen. There's so many things happening on Netflix and streaming services now that have been really cool for authors. So yeah, it would be awesome if something happened.
Well, cross our fingers. A lot of readers would love to see that, I'm sure.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Let's take a break. We'll come back and talk about the latest book, The Unwedding. We're talking with Ali Condie, who is a Utah-based author of the number one New York Times bestselling Match series. We've just been talking about that. The Edgar Award finalist Summer Lost and other novels, including several picture books. She's a former English teacher and resides outside of Salt Lake City with her four children. You can find her at AliCondi.com, by the way, AliCondi.com. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Utah-based writer Ali Condie. We're going to get into talking about her latest novel, The Unwedding. She's the author of the number one New York Times bestselling Matched series, also the Edgar Award finalist Summer Lost, among other novels, including several picture books. And you can find her at AliCondi.com. So and I would just read Ali Condie a little bit of the synopsis of this book. Ellery Wainwright is alone at the edge of the world. She and her husband Luke were supposed to spend their 20th anniversary together at the luxurious resort at Broken Point in Big Sur, California. Where better to celebrate a marriage, a family, and a life together than one of the most stunning places on earth? But now she's traveling solo. To add insult to injury, there's a wedding at Broken Point scheduled during her stay. And when Ellery discovers the body of the groom floating in the pool in the rain, she realizes she's not the only one whose future is no longer guaranteed. But before the police can arrive, a mudslide takes out the road, and so Ellery is left to solve the murder. How did this one come about?
So this one was personal, and they all are in some way, but this one maybe more than others. So I was right before COVID happened in the fall of 2019, my 20-year marriage ended, and I ended up going on a trip alone that was supposed to be our 20th wedding anniversary trip. Actually, what had happened was my ex took someone else on what would have been our 20th anniversary trip. And so I decided, oh, I'm going to try to do something positive and I'll go on a trip as well. And I was pretty used to traveling alone because for book tour, I had to do that. And and other things. You know, I'm an adult. I can handle that, but this felt different, and I realized it was because I no longer had kind of that anchor at home. My kids were living with in a home that I didn't have access to part of the time. It was just different. And so I was feeling pretty sorry for myself and looking around at everyone else at this resort that I went to. And it was not a resort in Big Sur, which is the case in the book. And I'll talk more about why I chose that later. And so I ended up just going ahead and feeling sad and sitting there at dinner. And then I started looking around and thought, I'm the only one here without someone else. And then pretty soon the author part, the people watching part kicked in. And I was paying attention. Oh, that couple looks so cute. They're so happy. Oh, that's a darling family. This and this and this. And then I thought, if there were a murder, I'd be the only one who could solve it because I'm the only one here paying attention to everyone else. And then I thought, do I have a book idea? And as we kind of referenced earlier, I was under contract to write some young adult novels. I was that nobody was asking for this. And so I do always have sort of a side project when I'm working on my contract work or the book that I'm supposed to be writing. And that's something that I work on for fun. Just to kind of, if I'm stuck, if I get writer's block, I think, okay, you're stuck here, but you can go work on your fun project. And so I started doing that as just a fun project. And pretty quickly I thought, I'm going to set it in Big Sur, because I wanted to have sort of a locked room, locked resort mystery, like in The Mousetrap with Agatha Christie or something like that. And so I had visited Big Sur before, but I hadn't been with my husband, so it was a place I could go to in my mind and imagine and think about how fun it would be, and not have sort of any association there. And also it's a place that does get cut off from time to time with the mudslides and things. And I'd read an article about how they'd had to airlift people out of the luxury resort when there was a slide there in 2017. So I thought, this doesn't require too much suspension of disbelief that a circumstance like this could arise here. And so once I had the idea in the setting, I was sort of off and running, and that's how that book sort of unfolded.
Yeah, fascinating. So you mentioned Agatha Christie. Who's that? Any mystery writer, that's probably one model.
Yeah, oh my gosh, I'm a huge fan. I started reading her when I was 11 or 12, and it's just I've loved her books ever since, and they stand the test of time. I mean, there's been some edits made because the climate has changed, and that makes perfect sense, but her dialogue still stands up, her mysteries still stand up, and so definitely I was thinking about her. Of course, I could never even come close, but it's fun to try.
So there's some conventions, I think, right? You have to, readers are expecting that you'll leave some clues, but as a writer, you're going to obscure some clues as well. Agatha Christie is criticized sometimes for, obscuring clues a little too much, but of course that makes the payoff that much more fun. So how did you your first mystery novel? How did you navigate that?
I did try to pattern myself a little bit after her in that my writing style is very different. I mean, she was a genius, but thinking, okay, she would make you care about all the characters. She would give you background on, but in just the right amount of background. There were always a few people who could have done it with compelling reasons. So there were quite a few things that I thought of as I was doing that and making it believable, but also interesting. And she's funny. And I don't know. I hope mine was funny in places, but she does a really good job of there are characters who are humorous. And so I was thinking about her a lot, and also other mystery authors that I've read, but for sure her as well.
So as reading about the or maybe viewing an event you did, one of the I hadn't thought about this, but one of the conventions is, there's a dead body, but then there has to be another dead body, right? It has to be there has to be a killer on the loose here, right? Not just one accidental death kind of thing.
Yeah, that is definitely a paradigm or a paradigm, a pattern that you see where there's still the urgency of they might kill again, they might not be stopping, and that, yes, that was something that I definitely was doing as well.
Now you've talked about, in fact, you had a whole back and forth, I understand, with your your editor, I guess, on how Ellery should react to finding a dead body.
Yeah, so that was actually with my agent.
Your agent, okay.
Yeah, and that was very funny. She kept saying, I think she's kind of overreacting here. She keeps screaming and freaking out, and I just feel like this is a bit of an overreaction. And I kept thinking to myself, well, she's found a dead body. Of course she's going to react in all these ways. And then, it'd been a few months of us kind of fine-tuning this and tweaking this, and we talked about other things as well. And then one day my agent said, well, when I found a dead body, I didn't react like that. And I said, wait, what? Where? I've known her since 2009, and I had no idea she'd ever found a dead body, and we're good friends. We've traveled together. And so I was just laughing. I said, you buried the lead. Why didn't you tell me this the first time? Of course, I'll adapt it to whatever you think it should be. Now you have actual experience with this. So yeah, that was, I mean, it was really sad that she found a dead body, and that was hard, but I had no idea that she'd had real life experience with this.
Now, I guess one factor here is your dad's a retired judge.
He
I
is,
believe
yeah, he is.
would he be able to tell you about cases? I guess maybe after the fact.
Yeah, so he's retired, so he can talk about them after, never during. He couldn't, but he actually prefers not to. And to him, this is a genre. This is a mystery. I try to be really respectful of life and of the person, but for him, it's not fiction. And I love that about him, that he didn't want to talk shop. He's like, yeah, I'll tell you about the experience after it's over and it's no longer an issue. But he's super respectful, and he's like, it's fine. He doesn't have any qualms about me writing a murder mystery, but he's like, real people die, and that is different. And he pays a lot of respect. He would never talk about like flippantly or in any way for entertainment. And so that is something I did kind of try to put in the book in a small way. I don't want it to feel like gratuitous or like the people who die don't matter. But for him, obviously, it's on a whole different level. It's real, actual people. So.
I was interested at the beginning of the book. You have the very familiar rhyme, but you have a version which you've added to it, I guess. Or I want to just read this: something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. So far so familiar, right? Someone lost, someone wed, someone broken, someone dead. Is that your addition?
Yeah, it is. We were just trying to kind of give a little, just there's often something small at the beginning of a mystery or a book to set the scene, and that was just something I thought of one day and wrote out, and my agent and editor liked it. Just here's what we're kind of, just a sense of the book or what we're doing, and that was fun.
So this came about, as most things do from your experience. This is not only a murder mystery, but it's the meditation on grief and loss and change, right? You felt unmoored at this point in your life. So that's coming from inside. Also, I guess observing people, observing people kind of unmoored and at a loss. I don't know.
Yeah, I think a friend of mine, so I got divorced in September 2019, and then March 2020 was COVID when it began. Well, I mean, it had begun before then, but that's when it sort of hit the US in earnest. And I have a friend who refers to that as the year the world got pulled out from underneath all of us. And I feel like, yeah, that was like a sort of community grief and specific grief for people who lost people during that. And so I think grief was very much in the air. It always is. People are always losing people, but that felt a little bit more of a community grief or experienced on a scale at the same time. So yeah, that I was thinking about that. I do think about grief a lot. I guess just as a human in the world, we experience it, or the people we love experience it. And I wanted to write a book that was honest about that, because grief is really hard. But one of the beautiful things is it may not always be the person you wish would come for you, but for as far as people, we often do show up for one another, and are there to catch each other when we fall. And I think we did see some of that as well in the pandemic and in life. And that is a beautiful part of grief.
So how do we navigate grief? Part of it, I guess, it takes the time it takes, right? And you say unexpected people show up and help you, or you show up unexpectedly in someone else's life.
Yeah, and I think it is part of the human experience is to love is to grieve, and there's just not any way around that, unfortunately.
So collectively, in some ways, it feels like, some days COVID never happened for me, and other days I think, man, what trauma am I still experiencing?
Oh, for sure. And I was lucky enough not to lose anyone. I have friends who lost parents and friends who lost people that are very dear to them. And so, yeah, I think for me, it's sort of that community grief. I didn't have a specific person that I lost. So for me, it's a little easier to move past that, but it did stamp us. And I had young kids during that time, and there were things they didn't get to do that they won't get back. And that happens, and it's okay in a lot of ways, but also I think sometimes as a parent you wish you could fix things for your kids, and you can't.
So you're going to continue in this genre?
Yeah, I'm working on a murder mystery right now. Another one for the same publisher, Grand Central Publishing, which is with Hachette. So my editor at I'm still with the same editor at Penguin Denton. Random House, all of those names for my young adult, but we took it elsewhere because she doesn't do adult. And so now I'm at a different publisher and they did for that, and they did want another murder mystery, which was super exciting for me. So that's been fun and it's really fun to work on. This one is set in the Narrows of Zion, and I grew up in Southern Utah, so that's been a delight to revisit.
So those settings, I guess that's comes from what you know, right? Cedar City area growing up. I'd understand that Ithaca shows up in one of your books. Just places you've been, I guess, or experienced.
Yeah, they do. They really do. And it's fun to write about places I've never been, but I don't seem to do that. Yeah, I've invented worlds, and so I've never been there, but as
That's
far
true,
as
yeah.
Yeah, as far as contemporary literature, I do tend to stay, or not stay, I do tend to like to go exploring and find places to write about, which is really fun. But I think
Yeah.
I've covered all my hometowns except Provo, so I guess they're up next.
Oh, okay, maybe Provo's next. Yeah, I was just thinking, Atlantia, for example. You've never lived under the sea, for example, but
That's right. I've never lived underwater, so.
yeah. Let's take another break. We'll come back with a final segment with Ali Condie. You can find her at alicondie.com. The latest book is The Unwedding. By the way, before we go to break, Reese's Book Club, that's a big get.
Oh, yeah, that was really exciting and surprising.
Yeah, I guess that probably boosts sales, and it's a nice thing to, and then the publisher puts it on puts it on the jacket.
Yeah, no, it's huge, and it was such a shot in the arm for, especially for a fo first book in this genre and for this audience. It was such a gift.
Yeah. We'll have more with Ali Condie following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Utah-based author Ali Condie. She is New York Times best-selling author of the Matched trilogy. The latest is The Unwedding, selling very well, much worth the read. Ali Condie, we have a few more minutes here. I want to talk about, I think it's your previous book, The Only Girl in Town, which is so fascinating. I wanted to have a chance to talk to you a little bit about this one as well.
Oh, thank you.
Here's a little bit of synopsis. What would you do if everyone you love disappeared? What if it was your fault? For Julie Fielding, nothing's been the same since that summer before her senior year. And goes, I won't. That's intriguing enough, I think, to draw people in a little bit. How did this book come about?
This one is so in this one it's like the concept is she walks out of the forest after a hike, and her whole town has disappeared. Well, not the town, the buildings are there, but the people are all gone, and clues keep popping up, but she has to figure out where did they go, can she get them back, why are they gone. And I think I got the idea again from decades before. I used to teach a short story by Ray Bradbury called There Will Come Soft Rains. And in that story, it's set in the future and the nuclear holocaust has happened and there's no humans. It's about a house, a self-cleaning house, because it's the future and that technology has been developed that just keeps cleaning and cleaning and cleaning itself. And so that was a fascinating story for me to read and then to be able to teach. And as I was thinking about this book, I thought, I want it to feel like the people are still there, which you definitely feel in Bradbury's story. I want you to still care about them and wonder what happened. And so that was kind of the entry point for that novel. And then I went from there. And that was a fun run to write, and also a really hard one to write. She's alone and she's sad too. She's missing people. But in that case, I don't think I'm giving too much away. It does not end with a nuclear holocaust or like a Ray Bradbury-esque scenario. There is some hope there. And so that was enjoyable to write as well. And it was fun to work to write within those constraints. Sometimes when you have constraints in writing like that, it makes you do new things and it takes the story in directions that you can't typically take it in. And I really love that part as well of the process.
You said you know, you started out, you had this idea, but you didn't know if it was going to be science fiction or paranormal. What you ended up
Yeah.
with, on was slipstream fiction. What is that?
So that's a term I've heard where it's like everyday life, and it's contemporary, it's set in our world, modern times, or it can be a bit in the past too, but then it becomes historical fiction pretty quickly. But one element is off. One element is different. It's not magic, it's not true sci-fi. It's just one thing different. And so that's the phrase that I've heard used to describe that genre of literature is slipstream, which I think is pretty, that feels evocative to me. That feels like a good thing to call it.
This one, I don't know, it puts me in mind of the pandemic as well. You wake up and everybody's gone, or you're
Yeah.
removed now from everybody, right? And then how do you deal with that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we definitely did feel that for sure. And for me, I did feel that too, the pandemic, when for the first time in my life I lived alone. I'd always had roommates or parents or a family. And then there were a few times when my kid's dad would take them, like for the weekend and stuff, I was by myself and we couldn't access other people in that way. And so I had started writing the book before that, but that really helped me get in the mindset of, oh my word, there is nobody here. So
Yeah, that's and then working through that. You
right.
talked about maybe you talk a little bit more about making absent characters real. That must be an art.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I how well I succeeded. I definitely wanted to and tried, but there is the element of the flashback is used in almost all fiction, and it's definitely helpful there
Yeah, I
because
suppose that,
in
yeah.
order for them to feel real, you had to spend some time with them. And so that flashbacks were something I realized I was going to need to use pretty early on.
I want to talk about young readers and writers. This is a passion of yours, your Write Out Foundation. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so that has been a little bit defunct since the pandemic. Just I've undergone a lot of change in my personal life and started teaching and writing more books. So we've hit pause on that a little bit, but we did it for several years and I just loved it. We still have the nonprofit. Hopefully someday we'll get the conference going again. But what we would do is we would bring readers to Cedar City, Utah, where I think I mentioned earlier I'm from. And it was We would scholarship 20 of our readers, which was a quarter of them, from areas that didn't get kind of more rural areas, writers who didn't often have a chance to attend something like this. And having it in Cedar City was also intentional because I never saw an author come through and visit when I was there. And bigger cities tend to have more of that. So I wanted to bring something to rural areas. So we would have authors come and we would workshop. They'd get to workshop with New York Times bestselling authors, their own work, and then we'd also take them to a national park and play at the Utah Shakespeare Festival, because often people in rural areas or even in in urban areas, they don't have access to the things that everyone else gets to do. Like I was part of a, and still am actually part of a festival in Los Angeles that's a nonprofit for teen readers. And there were kids who had never seen the beach, but they'd grown up in LA. So it was kind of, I got that idea definitely from them. Like, no, let's take you to see all these awesome things that we have right here that we just assume people have access to and they don't always. So that was definitely a passion project, something I'd love to get started again. We just, it was hard to get funding and hopefully we'll be able to figure out a way to do that more effectively in the future.
I just have a couple minutes left. I'm curious how kids encounter books these days. Is it all electronic? And is the library still important
Yeah,
for
I'm on
kids?
the board of the Provo Library, and so I feel really strongly about that, about the importance of the library and the importance of and kids still are accessing it, and the library serves so many communities that need books, that need access to books and computers and all the things that they have there. But yeah, I mean, a lot of kids do have their attention diverted into different ways. So it's become more and more imperative for us to try to help them think, help them read, help them not use AI to generate stuff. It's not about like getting an assignment done on time. It's about learning the skills to think critically. And reading does that and writing does that. And so I feel like we're at a disadvantage in a lot of ways, but also kids are always kids. They're always interesting. They're always interested. They always have flexible, interesting brains. And so, if we can get them in the door reading, writing, they'll do magical things like they always have been doing. So, that's the goal.
Well, we reached the end of our hour. I've been talking with Utah-based author Ali Condie, author of the number one New York Times bestselling Match series, others like Summer Lost and Only Girl in Town, and we've been talking about her latest, The Unwedding, and imagine Ali Condie, the next murder mystery about what next year?
I think it'll be 2026.
Okay.
but I do have a couple of picture books coming out next
All
year,
right,
so
we'll look for those as well. You can
thank you so much.
find out Ali Condie at aliconde.com. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a delight.
And thanks everyone for listening. And we'll go out as we do on Wednesdays with Beehive Archive. Thanks everyone.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Weiss. Living in a historic home can be lovely, but for Spring City residents in the 1970s, the influx of so-called outsiders sprucing up pioneer-era historic dwellings was a source of contention. Learn more after this.
I'm Jody Graham, Director of Utah Humanities. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by Utah Humanities, with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation. We are proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories and hope you will tune in each week for the Beehive Archive.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. During the 1970s, Spring City residents used federal preservation funds to transform their town into a model for heritage tourism. Located in the heart of San Pete County, Spring City's architecture is mostly original to the 1849 Latter-day Saint settlement of the area. 19th-century homes and religious structures, such as the Bishop's Tithing House, serve as classic examples of Mormon frontier architecture with Danish folk influences. Many of these historic buildings were converted into family homes or art studios in the 1970s. For some residents, however, the transition of this rural community into a heritage tourism site was not straightforward. Louisa Bennion grew up in Spring City as it was redefining itself as an artist colony and historic preservation mecca. Bennion's parents restored a historic home there, motivated by the loss they felt witnessing changes to their original home of Orem, where subdivisions replaced orchards in the post-war period. At the time, Spring City's population was so low, it was actually declared a ghost town. Then, its elevation to a National Historic District led to an influx of so-called outsiders, driven to restore and save the town, but which also dramatically changed the culture of the community. Locals whose families had lived there for generations faced tensions with the newcomers, called incomes and weekenders, who saw any alteration to historic homes for new amenities as essentially, quote, cutting off their nose to spite their face, unquote. In this tense atmosphere, Bennion reflected simply, quote, when I was a little girl growing up in an old house in Spring City, I knew of only two kinds of politics, the politics of water and the politics of historic preservation, unquote. Today, Spring City is famous for having the whole town on the National Register of Historic Places. One local nonprofit even hosts a yearly festival, touring visitors to see the impressive restoration of the town's dwellings through open home tours. In Utah, road trippers often seek out communities established in the 19th century that maintain picturesque and lively main streets. For such towns, this visitation is economically and culturally important. But there are politics to preserving these old buildings, and tensions around old versus new are ever present for many rural Utahns, even today. Find sources in past episodes of the Beehive Archive at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of Utah Humanities, I'm Megan Weiss.